Today is Wednesday, March the 13th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and I ask you, Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Streaming live on the Internet on prn.live. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank at pcradioshow.org. Solid-state drives are getting more expensive again because the biggest NAND supplier has throttled production to half its previous output. And where the leader goes, so the rest of the mob is likely to follow. Last year was the perfect time to buy an SSD. For less than $100, you could get a couple of terabytes of really fast storage, even from the top brands. That's not the case now, and you have to shop around to find a good deal. And the reason for this is simple. Samsung, the largest supplier of flash memory, has reduced production to such an extent that its factories are churning out 50% fewer chips than in the previous year. News of this move isn't particularly surprising, as the industry had been talking about reducing output for a good while. However, the sheer size of the decrease is quite alarming, and it's only going to mean that solid-state drive prices will continue to rise as the inventory of flash memory chips begins to dwindle. This is because it's not just Samsung that's scaling back production. Other NAND manufacturers such as Kioxia, I'm probably not pronouncing properly, but it's a spin-off of Toshiba, Micron, and SK Hynix will almost certainly follow suit. By constraining supply, the high demand will force prices to rise, though this is something that's been going on in the flash memory industry for years. And more recently, the growth in AI supercomputers is also partly responsible for the increase of solid-state drive prices, as the creation of all these machines for generative AI requires thousands of medium-capacity, high-speed flash memory chips. The general server market still prefers the traditional hard disk drive as the primary choice of long-term storage, though SSDs are making headway in this area too. However, it's not necessarily all doom and gloom. Some suppliers may choose to not follow Samsung's lead and instead do the opposite. Chinese manufacturers such as YMTC, whose memory chips are used by Silicon Power, ADATA, and countless others, may see this as an opportunity to flood the market with mountains of cheap NAND flash. One might think that since many of the best solid-state drives are created by the chip manufacturers themselves, for example, Samsung, Western Digital, Crucial, it will only be the lesser-known brands that will snap them up. But there are some excellent solid-state drives out there, such as the Lexar NM790, which use YMTC chips, and they're just as fast as anything from Samsung, and all without the high price tag. So while we can expect solid-state drive prices to continue to rise throughout 2024, it would be surprising if there wasn't a push from competitors in the NAND flash market to make a bid to, well, compete with the big guy. Microsoft to reduce Windows 11 update restarts with hot patching. What the heck is hot patching? Hot patching allows updates to be applied without rebooting, improving, of course, the user experience. Everybody knows that it's important to keep Windows updated, but very few people enjoy the process of actually updating their computer. Veteran Windows users will have bad memories of being constantly pestered by Windows to restart their device or even their PCs, restarting by themselves during an inopportune moment. Now Microsoft is working to remove the number of times you need to restart your Computer 11 PC to restart it, with the best case scenario being one restart every 3 months. Microsoft wants to implement something called hot patching. This is when a system downloads and applies an update without having to restart afterward. The company already has the technology in place for its Azure server virtual machines. Hot patching is a way to install OS security updates on supported Windows Server data center, Azure Edition, virtual machine, VMs, that doesn't require a reboot after installation. It works by patching the in-memory code of running processes without the need to restart the process. Right now, this feature is restricted to virtual machines on Azure servers. However, Microsoft plans to apply this same hot patching feature to Windows 11. The source also states that Microsoft hopes to get hot patching onto people's x86 and 64-bit computers as part of the Windows 11 24H2 update in mid-2024. People using Windows on ARM devices will receive hot patching in 2025. Unfortunately, hot patching does not mean you never have to restart your Windows PC to apply updates. Hot patching works by building upon the current baseline, and Microsoft will need to adjust this baseline with a normal update every so often. However, these baseline patches may only come every once every 3 months, assuming that an emergency baseline patch isn't released to protect users from zero-day threats. Still, we'll take a lot of obstacles out of the process of installing the latest Windows update. If implemented properly, you may not even notice Windows applying the update. This does raise the question whether Microsoft will allow people to manually check for and install updates. But given how Microsoft has auto-updated Windows 11 PCs in 23H2, it's a sign that we might not get a say in the future. Apple officially warns users to stop putting wet iPhones in rice. The company said the popular remedy could cause small particles of rice to damage your iPhone. For years, owners of drowned iPhones have sworn by the rice-soaking hack. Apple is raining on their parade. Saving a wet iPhone by putting it in a bowl or bag of uncooked rice has been a popular go-to rescue method for years, with the logic being that the rice absorbs the excess water from the phone. However, Apple has recently warned poor mortals against resorting to rice in these situations, saying it could make things worse. In a recent support document, Apple states that putting wet devices in a bag of rice could allow small particles of rice to damage your iPhone. Although it doesn't go into further detail, the company also recommended against using other well-known hacks, such as using an external heat source to dry the phone or sticking a cotton swab into the connector. Apple's recent advice was spotted by Macworld. The company's warning on ice coincides with those of other repair experts who have found that the rice hack works slower than simply leaving your iPhone on the counter to dry. Time is crucial in these situations, as the most important thing is to prevent the water from damaging the electronics inside the phone. Instead of resorting to rice, Apple provides users with an alternative solution. If your iPhone or charging connector is wet, in the latter case, an alert will appear and disable charging. Apple recommends the following. Unplug the cable from your iPhone and unplug the other end of the cable from the power adapter or accessory. Don't plug the cable in again until your iPhone and the cable are completely dry. Tap your iPhone gently against your hand with the connector facing down to remove excess liquid. Leave your iPhone in a dry area with some airflow. After at least 30 minutes, try charging with a Lightning or USB-C cable or connecting an accessory. If you see the light again, there is still liquid in the connector or under the pins of your cable. Leave your iPhone in the dry area with some airflow for up to a day. You can try again to charge or connect an accessory throughout this period. It may take up to 24 hours to fully dry. If your phone has dried out but still isn't charging, unplug the cable from the adapter and unplug the adapter from the wall and then connect them again. In case Apple's advice doesn't work, it's safe to say you probably need help from professional repair experts and may even need to prepare yourself to buy a new iPhone. Whatever you do, resist the temptation of reaching for the rice. Linux, market share after 33 years. Linux, despite being around for more than 30 years, has a relatively small market share compared to other operating systems like Microsoft Windows and Apple Mac OS. However, it has been seeing some growth in recent years. Linux has been widely adopted and dominates in server, cloud, and Internet of Things environment due to its exceptional performance, stability, reliability, and security. Its open source nature and flexibility makes it a popular choice for these use cases. On the desktop front, however, Linux has not gained as much popularity among regular computer users as Windows or Mac OS. There are several factors that contribute to this. A major factor has been a lack of marketing and corporate backing. Unlike Windows, Mac OS, and Android and Linux are not backed by a single corporate entity with a dedicated marketing team. This lack of corporate support and marketing efforts limited its visibility and adoption. Many commercial applications are designed to run on Windows, which has widespread usage and compatibility, while Linux offers a wide range of open source software. Some proprietary software may not be available or fully compatible with Linux and making it less appealing to certain users. Linux has made significant improvements in terms of interface features and services over the years. However, some users may still perceive it as less user-friendly compared to Windows or Mac OS, which can deter adoption among less tech-savvy individuals. Linux has gained popularity among developers and technical users who appreciate its customization options, command line interface, and development tools. It is widely used in the developer community, with 45% of programmers reportedly using Linux. Despite its relatively small market share, Linux has been making progress on the desktop front. It recently achieved its highest market share ever, reaching 4% of the desktop PC OS market share. This growth can be attributed to factors such as increased awareness, improved user experience, and the growing popularity of open source software. Linux market share passes 4% for the first time. Linux was 6.34% of the computers last month, if you count Chrome OS. Linux reached 4.03% of global market share in February, according to data from research firm StatCounter. That takes Linux past the 3% milestone it reached in June of 2023. While we're still far from the year of the Linux desktop, interest in Linux has somewhat grown lately. StatCounter says it gets its desktop operating system OS usage stats from tracking code installed on over 1.5 million global websites, generating over 5 billion monthly page views. Note that when StatCounter analyzes desktop OSs, it also includes laptop computers. Linux reported desktop market share was higher than ever in February. If you count Chrome OS as the Linux OS, then market share totaled 6.34% in February, although that number is actually smaller than what StatCounter reported in June, which was 2%. But if we focus on the Linux numbers alone, we see the nearly 33-year-old OS market share growing 31.3% from June of last year, when they last reported on the Linux market share. Since June, Linux usage has mostly increased gradually. Overall, there's been a big leap in usage compared to 5 years ago. In February of 2019, Linux was reportedly on 1.58% of desktop globally. Since June, Chrome OS adoption took a bit of a dive, representing 2.27% of the worldwide market last month. In October, Google's Chromebook OS reached 4.01% market share, but has been mostly declining since. Windows dominance, meanwhile, mostly increased between June and February, when the Microsoft OS was reportedly on 72.17% of computers. Mac OS, meanwhile, has seen desktop market share drop from 21.32% in June to 15.42% in February. That's a big drop. StatCounter's newest numbers show an uptick in Linux usage over the past months. Ultimately, the big OS players are still by far Windows and Mac OS, which represented 87.59% of desktop OSs in February. In the United States specifically, Linux desktop market share missed the 4% line, hitting 3.85% in February. But that's still an improvement from U.S. usage in June of last year, which was 1.96%. Despite this growth, though, we, of course, remain far from any sort of year of the Linux desktop, where Linux is the dominant desktop OS. There's plenty of debate over why Linux founder Linus Torvalds, for example, has suggested that a lack of standardized desktop that goes across all Linux distros has held back Linux adoption on desktop. Still, it's interesting to watch usage of the open source OS grow, especially as fragmentation and app discovery improve. It's a slow climb that will slowly never result in Linux sitting at the peak of the desktop OS mountain. But big gains like in India, where Linux has reportedly been the second biggest desktop OS, highlight the proclivity that certain technologists have towards Linux. Should you upgrade Windows Home to Windows Pro? It's a good question. PC makers love to sell new computers loaded with Windows Home Edition. You can upgrade to Windows Pro for a price, of course, but should you do it? The majority of computers you see for sale at local retail outlets or in online stores aimed primarily at consumers come with Windows 11 Home Edition pre-installed. If you're buying that PC for work, do you need to upgrade to the Pro Edition? And what's the best way to do that without spending a fortune? The reason you see so many PCs pre-installed with Home Edition is simple: dollars and cents. The PC industry is extremely price sensitive, and Windows Home Edition costs the PC makers less than the Pro Edition, which in turn allows them to cut the price tag on a PC model by $50 or more. For most consumers, however, Home Edition is good enough. Businesses that run on Windows Enterprise networks or that use business editions of Microsoft 365 need Pro Edition, because it's required to join a PC to a Windows domain or Azure Active Directory account and then manage that PC with group policy and mobile device management software. Do you need to upgrade to Windows Pro Edition? Pro Edition does have a few added features that you might be willing to pay for, especially if you're planning to use your PC for business. It supports full BitLocker encryption without requiring the user to sign into a Microsoft account. It also allows the use of Microsoft information protection features for secure document sharing. Another is you can get to use the full Hyper-V virtualization platform to create and run virtual machines. The Windows Sandbox features allow you to spin up an instant virtual machine for test purposes. It's completely isolated from the main Windows installation, and every trace of your activity vanishes when you close the sandbox. You can configure Pro Edition to be a remote desktop server, allowing you to connect to it remotely from another Windows PC, even when one running Home Edition, or from a Mac or a mobile device. Instead of installing updates on Microsoft's schedule, you can set up custom schedules for devices, deferring updates for up to 30 days while you wait for other people to experience other update-related bugs. Using a feature called Assign Access, previously known as Kiosk Mode, you can lock down a user account so it can only use a single app. You see anything on this list that you might need? If not, the Home Edition pre-installed is just fine. Why your Wi-Fi router might lock out your older devices? Just upgraded your router and noticed that your old device isn't connecting to Wi-Fi? This can sometimes happen when WPA3, the latest Wi-Fi security standard, doesn't support your old device. The good news is there are a few ways around this problem. The bad news is you're probably better off just buying a brand new laptop or tablet. WPA3 or Wi-Fi Protected Access 3 is the successor to WPA2. It is also the security protocol that keeps modern Wi-Fi networks safe. WPA3 was introduced in 2018, 12 years after WPA2 made its debut. Current standard includes four features its predecessor doesn't have: public network privacy, brute force attack protection, more accessible connection options for display-free devices, and higher security for government, defense, and industrial applications. WPA3 also became mandatory for Wi-Fi certified devices back in July of 2020. So, if you bought your new router since then, you're using WPA3 now, or your network is at least capable of supporting it. But despite rolling out 4 years ago, not all devices and routers have moved over from WPA2. It's also worth noting that WPA3 isn't some impenetrable super protocol either. No protocol or device is 100% safe. WPA3 is still immensely superior to WPA2. Devices manufactured around the time of WPA3's debut and beyond should be okay, as companies saw the upgrade coming and prepared for it. Some devices from around that early period also have updates to enable them to connect to WPA3 networks. You can't build a device and guarantee it will work with a protocol that doesn't exist yet. Older hardware may also be incapable of installing the update that included WPA3 compatibility. Older devices running older software are also a security nightmare, so locking them out makes sense for a couple of reasons. The main one is a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. If you're upgrading your home network for the security benefits, that old phone or tablet is probably the easiest way through your defenses. So the inevitable complete withdrawal of support for WPA2 devices make a lot of sense from a security perspective. And security is the main reason for the upgrade in the first place. Downgrading to WPA2 will fix the problem, but it's a bad idea. If everything you own won't work with a new WPA3 protocol, the obvious solution is to roll back to the one that functioned, right? Wrong. When the standard shifts, companies withdraw support for obsolete protocols and software. This support isn't just to fix apparent bugs, it also fends off the horde of hackers continuously probing every bit of code available for exploits. Those exploits are regularly found even in supported software. The difference with supported software is the company that made its reaction to attacks. When a hacker finds a vulnerability, the company quickly becomes aware of this. That company then puts every effort into patching the exploit and rolling that patch out as soon as possible. This is well worth doing with your latest software. It isn't worth supporting the obsolete stuff a small fraction of your customer base insists on clinging to. The exploits will only worsen and become more numerous as modern computing becomes more powerful by comparison, and the number of people who benefit from that support is negligible. If you're desperate to cling to your WPA2 devices until they die a natural death, there is some good news. While it may have been impossible for device manufacturers to prepare for the standard switch, the company that made your router may have allowed for some backward compatibility. A WPA2 and a WPA3 transitional period is available on some routers. This will allow all of your devices to connect to your home network. The newer devices capable of using WPA3, more recent tablets, laptops, and phones, will connect using the more secure protocol, while devices limited to WPA2 will connect to that too. You have to dig around your router settings to enable transitional mode. Even if you keep your Wi-Fi network open to a 10-year-old device, The company responsible for that device's security has almost certainly withdrawn support by now. Plus, the chances are that it isn't powerful enough to run the latest incarnations of this software, even if it was made available. This does not apply to all devices equally. A 5-year-old phone is more likely to struggle with 2022 software than a 5-year-old laptop. As smartphones have shortened lifespans, but either way, incompatibility with something like the current Wi-Fi standard is probably a sign you should move on. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace. We talk, well, okay, a lot of different things have been happening in the workplace. I spent the first few segments of the year talking about quiet quitting, quiet firing, loud quitting, quiet hiring. These are business items that are all coming out of the result of us packing up our computers, taking them home, and doing work from home for a few years. Along the way, people decided, hey, rightfully so, that working from home saves a lot. It saves on a lot of our dressing up. It saves a lot on our clothing. It saves a lot on our wear and tear on our bodies as we commute an hour each way to work, whatever it is. And with that, some people are still trying to hold on by doing another item, which I've seen a little bit of it, and lately it's really starting to grow. It's this concept of coffee badging. And this is where people are told, hey, you've got to come into the office. You have to show your face at the office every day, or even just a few times a week. And what some of the people are doing is this coffee badging. What does that mean? Well, it means that they drive into the office, however far it is, they show their face, they have a coffee, they do the water cooler gossip, they hang out with, you know, the coworkers for a short while, and then they badge out and head on home. They show up just to goof off, and this is going to hurt. This is actually going to hurt business more than the whole idea of work from home. Yes. These people are performing the responsibility of showing up to the office as requested, but they're not doing their work at home, at the office. They're going on back and they're performing and sometimes even overperforming at home, making up for it. So there is some upside to the idea of us doing that FaceTime, that in-person visit, but is it going to hurt the business over the long haul? Yes, because you're demanding that they do something, that they found the loophole, they found the way around it, and that's only going to encourage them to look for more loopholes, to continue doing what they found is the best way for them to work. I feel, and I've stated this before, I feel that the best way for businesses to move forward is to make sure that your employees are as productive as they can be. If you're having them come into the office and all they're doing is doing the coffee and the water cooler gossip and then heading on home, that's actually something that they would have done if had they stayed in the office too. That's another problem. I will tell you, I remember working for a company and I would arrive at the office and I would be there for probably 15 minutes, half an hour, and at least one or two people would walk on by and go, hey, you want to go grab a cup of, well, in my case, tea. And we would chat, we would catch up, and we would do the socialization, which I will admit, doing water cooler gossip is something that is kind of fun. It's enjoyable. It makes work a little bit less stressful, especially when you can do that in the middle of the day and you get that little break in the afternoon. You spend some time kind of catching up, but also bonding with fellow employees. However, One of the things that I've also found doing remote work, doing the idea of being 100% remote, which I am. My company that I work for, they are roughly 900 miles away from me. That's where the office is. I'm not going to go on in, but I have found a way to do some of that same camaraderie, some of that building of relationships with a number of different people by both scheduling meetings and saying, hey, at the end of a meeting where there's, you know, five of us or 10 of us or whatever it is, and saying, hey, so-and-so, hey, Joe, you got 5 minutes? And we spend just 5 minutes catching up. And that actually works out really well. And it's actually far more productive because when we're talking about going into the office and we start talking about a lot of that bunching together, a lot of people will start joining in with a coffee and that 5 minutes escalates pretty quickly. I will tell you, there's another thing too that the company I work for has built up a number of different socialization sessions with our team and with our extended team, where we get together and we shoot the breeze and we just have fun, which is great. These are ways to encourage all of us to actually work harder, for us to expand our knowledge of our coworkers and actually just get along. I will tell you that the idea of coffee badging may not be all that bad. A lot of employers are complaining about it, but it's still following the rules. If we start setting more rules, if we start saying, well, okay, you can't coffee badge anymore, then we're going to wind up in that same direction where we're going to make people miserable. Instead, shoot for the morale builders. Shoot for ways to team build, to really make people enjoy work. Yes, the paycheck does help. Yes, various perks along the way. But one of the biggest perks that has been around since the start of COVID is work from home. Don't eliminate it. Work through it. Find ways to enable people who want to escape from home to do exactly that. And for people who want to stay at home, to also do that. That would be my goal. That's my request. That's my guidance. And I hope that we find a way to make everybody happy. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The Trenton Computer Festival 2024 is the first and the longest-running computer festival in the world. Saturday, March the 16th, 2024. The hours are from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The event consists of 50-plus talks, workshops, tutorials, demos, and vendor fare. The theme of the festival this year is Putting Generative AI to Work, Promises and Problems. Are you interested in getting an amateur ham radio license? There is a license exam cram course at TCF that starts at 9 a.m. in preparation for the license test at 3:30 p.m. Dr. Rebecca Mercury is an avid advocate of ham radio. I asked her if ham radio is still relevant in this age of the internet. Rebecca, you have any answer for that?
Hi, absolutely. I've been an amateur radio operator for over 40 years now. It's hard to believe. And it's changed a lot. The field has changed considerably. Where once people were tapping out things on Morse code and talking, you know, on their handhelds, and then also talking long distance around the world using analog technologies. Amateur radio has gone majorly digital. You can just have the computers that you have, you're attached to your broadcast or your station, your amateur radio station. You can actually have it tap out the Morse code for you. You can have it translate the Morse code that it hears coming in. And so, so Morse code has actually been more popular than ever before. But amateur radio actually has a considerable number of digital modes, all sorts of things that you can do using digital technologies. And again, these are allowable by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. They have to go through stringent processes to recognize certain types of transmissions. And again, amateur radio operators are limited to certain types of broadcasting, which we don't really refer to. We call it communications, not broadcasting, as you would do on a commercial station. But anyway, why is it so important to us now? Maybe you don't know. The space station and most staffed missions into outer space have amateur radios on board. What happens if their communication system goes out? They use amateur radio. And in fact, on the International Space Station, they make sure that, those operations are working. They have to be licensed amateur radio operators with call signs, just like I have, K3RPM. But they have to be able to make sure that those radios are available and usable in case of emergencies if their communication systems go out. So it's, that's one example of it. But how about disasters, catastrophes? Look at all those fires that were happening up in Canada and, now down in Texas. What do people do there? All their infrastructure is being destroyed. Electricity is down. Power is down. Broadcasting is down. So amateur radio operators are there. That's one of our key phrases that we like to say. When all else fails, amateur radio is there. And so amateur radio operators are very, very much needed in disasters in order to provide communication services. And we practice for that. We do mass practices like we had an all-state New Jersey practice for an entire calamity. It was occurred on a Saturday. We knew in advance that it was going to happen, and we knew to prepare our equipment. But basically, at 8:30 a.m., you called in on a certain frequency, and they told you where you're going to be deployed to. I actually got deployed to the College of New Jersey, which was going to be a pretend site for a triage area where people who their homes were destroyed or whatever in this calamity, they would be able to go there and get services and have to sleep there overnight if necessary. So these are, it's practicing for a real actual disaster. I served at the Princeton Red Cross for 3 days after 9/11 occurred. And, we always say in emergency communications, take care of yourself and your family first. Make sure you have what you need, food, cash, things like that. And then deploy. So I made sure that my cats were fed and things like that. And then I spent 3 days at the Princeton Red Cross, helping to relay messages that were coming, from amateur radio operators at and near the 9/11 site to relay messages to hospitals, to survivors, to, all sorts of families, to all sorts of people. And, we did that and received a citation, for having performed in that service. Superstorm Sandy, big calamity here in New Jersey. Lots of shore communities were pretty much demolished. I went down there, drove down there afterwards, not during the situation, because I was deployed. But the, what a disaster. People had nowhere to go. They didn't know what to do. And there was an election coming up. So some people forget that Superstorm Sandy was right before an important election. And so they had to move people to where they could, they were using, I think, big vans where they were, used those as polling stations. So, but some of the things that, I did during Superstorm Sandy, I was at that time deployed to the Mercer County EOC, the Emergency, Operations for Communications. That is, again, in central Mercer County, and, work there, also again, relaying messages and things like that. So helping people find food, helping people find fuel, people were running out of fuel for their cars, things like that. So, cause all electricity was down, all sorts of disasters were happening. Now we have a situation where, a lot of our communications are in outer space using satellites, geostationary and other different types of satellites. And, but now we're in a period of crisis. Countries are being more hostile And I understand that a country across the other side of the world has been knocking out communication satellites. So they're very vulnerable up there. So it does not really take much to knock one of those out and disable it. And if enough of that is done, your GPS is not going to work. Recently, this was just a week or so ago, there was an outage of AT&T service, and many, many, many people, especially in New York, Chicago, I understand, North Jersey, all over the place, their AT&T service, if that was their cell phone service, it was knocked out. They were getting messages like, you know, all we have is emergency service available, and maybe not even that. What are you going to do? What if you're having a heart attack and you need to get an ambulance? What the heck are you going to do? Your phone's not working. So again, there's another important point about amateur radio is that it is there and can cover in these types of emergencies. Amateur radio operators often keep an amateur radio in their car so that way if there's some sort of road disaster and maybe also GPS is not working, that was one of the problems that people were having was that they had set their GPS to where they were going. They're now on the highway. They don't know where they're going and now their GPS doesn't work. So these are reasons for amateur radio still being very viable as much, if not more, than ever before. So more and more people are getting licensed as amateur radio operators.
So Rebecca, what you're telling me is that with the ever-changing technology, amateur radio is not going to disappear soon at all.
Not in any way. Not in any way. They believe that more amateurs are operating now than ever before.
And more now than ever before?
More now than ever before because the availability of it is so prolific. So I can log into a site in Germany and listen to radio there. I mean, I don't even have to set up, you know, all these big antennas and stuff like that like I used to have to do. I can just go on a site as an amateur radio operator. I have a call sign. I can gain access to that site and then operate from Germany or wherever I want to in the world where amateur radio is legal.
Where can I get the devices or what kind of devices I get to receive or listen to some of these
Okay, so it is sort of like back in the day of shortwave radio. My mom was a big fan. You could buy a shortwave radio and listen to all these different stations from all around the world. It does help to have the appropriate antennas to be able to receive the different bands. You can string some of those up as wire antennas and just build them yourself. But there's a bunch of companies. DX Engineering is one I like. There's a number of different companies that sell amateur radios. You can't transmit on them unless you actually have an amateur radio. It is illegal for you to transmit on any of those frequencies without a license. But you can hear the ham bands, as I say, you know, through these various radios. Some of them are as inexpensive. The popular local frequencies, a lot of people monitor, even if they're not a ham, are 2 meters and 70 centimeters. And you can buy a nice radio like that for your car for about $200. And it will also enable some of the other bands like 10 meters and 6 meters. But again, all of those four bands are illegal for you to operate on. Even if you buy a radio like that that comes with a microphone, take the microphone off and don't use it because that is illegal. But you can listen to the communications.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. And you know what? I'm going to have to get you back on to give us more detailed information. I have a lot more questions. I'll get you next time. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Glad to do it.
Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, you said something about New Year's resolution. We're a little bit late for that, aren't we?
Well, New Year's resolutions can happen after the New Year, right?
Okay, all right, fair enough.
You know, this product,
Doesn't have to happen New Year's Day. You can commit to it months later.
Right. Well, not only that, this really applies to New Year's resolutions as many people make that they may not have started in on yet.
Sure. And, or struggling, also, yeah.
It also is relevant to April 15th.
Yes, okay. Go on.
Did you resolve to get your receipts ready earlier this year as a head start on your tax return?
No.
Ever heard of ScanSnap?
Yes, I have.
It's a highly respected scanner brand, originally Fujitsu and then PFU, and now it's part of Ricoh, so we'll just call it ScanSnap. They sent their new iX1600 Receipt Edition, which integrates with QuickBooks Online.
Oh, nice. Okay.
All right. Now you can connect it old school to your PC over USB, but it has Wi-Fi. So connect your USB or smartphone wirelessly, or just use the scanner on its own and send all kinds of documents, receipts, business cards, and photos to ScanSnap Home, Evernote, or online drives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Receipt Edition recognizes and extracts info into QuickBooks that it wants to see. Print gets OCR analysis by Abby, A-B-B-Y-Y, which is veteran at that, to save pages as searchable PDFs. But there's the horsepower here that makes the rest of it special. It has an automatic document feeder where you can stack up to 50 sheets. It scans both sides at about 40 pages a minute. It can save to Word, to Excel, to PowerPoint, searchable PDFs, or JPEG. The feeder has a manual feed mode that can scan envelopes, plastic cards, folded A3 documents, and documents with sticky notes attached. And it does it all with 600 dot per inch resolution, about twice what original laser printers offered. Now, I've seen prices for new ScanSnap iX1600 Receipt Edition run $450 to $600, so you yourself should scan your options before you put it in your shopping cart.
This is, so I'm looking over the specs. So years ago, we went to the office I was working at. We went mostly paperless.
Yeah.
We would scan the papers as they were coming in. We'd shove them into boxes, and then it was all available online digitally.
Is your mailbox empty every morning?
My mailbox. But I'll tell you, the specs on this are what we were looking. I mean, those were the pro scanners back then. But, the speed and the resolution and the OCR, that would be the big question I've got is how fast is the OCR? But if it's but I'm sure it's gotten pretty good.
Well, OCR can work in the background, too. I mean, once you've done your scan, it's not necessarily got the OCR embedded yet. Give it a minute.
Sure, yeah. Very good stuff.
One item I want to get to, we've been neglecting tools in all of this.
Yeah, we haven't talked tools in, well over a month.
Well, so let's talk about the sawhorse.
Okay.
The sawhorse was invented to hold wood up off the ground to make the job of sawing more reasonable.
Yeah.
And the shape of it came about as close to the stance of a horse as the constellations of stars do to the animals that they represent.
There is that.
So what do you get if you kick a sawhorse up by a notch, or more precisely, a whole stack of notches? Let me tell you what I got.
Okay, yeah.
A pair of Bora, B-O-R-A, Bora Workhorse XT. Next gen sawhorses. These are heavy metal, all steel steeds that get stabled with their legs folded up into their backbones. So it's
I love how you draw these in. There isn't a pun that you don't like. I love it.
Unlock their keeper on the bottom. The legs swing down and spread out. A folded strut for each end's leg locks their stance. Legs themselves telescope, so you get a total height between 30 and 34 inches. The whole thing sets up faster than it takes to describe it. Each sawhorse can handle a maximum capacity of 1,350 pounds.
Okay, very nice.
A pair can hold 2,700 pounds. Each horse has brackets at both ends. They can fit a 2x2 or 2x4 stud, making the full support frame a rectangle that can let it hold sheet materials flat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those brackets also have, just for convenience, built-in bottle openers, and their spines have holes that make it easy to attach a sacrificial surface, like a piece of junk plywood that you can screw onto the top.
Yeah.
Now, the Bora Workhorse XT Next Gen Sawhorse cost just $55 each, or $110 a pair at Home Depot.
So for next gen, they aren't really going price-wise like so many people do. Oh, this is the next generation. It's going to be $7,000 for a Sawhorse.
No, they're more
this is definitely in that competitive range, and I love that. That is it definitely sounds very solid.
Yeah, pair holds more than a ton.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing, we won't get into it now, but we did get, and I'm sure you got, some new stuff in from Klein Tools. We've got to get around to someday to explaining to people.
As we're talking about all kinds of tools, yes, I actually haven't I haven't received a shipment from them recently, but that's more of my failing. I have to go through the checklist and go, I want one of these.
I don't. He just sends to me. I just got red and green laser cross line levels.
Oh, nice. I had seen that and I was like, I don't know if I need that. But, you know, maybe I do want it. There is that. As for now, this is Benjamin Rocco. That's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and the Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2024. The theme is Putting Generative AI to Work. It's the first and longest-running computer festival in the world. Saturday, March the 16th, the time of the festival is 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The website is tcf-nj.org for more information. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, March the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting Thursday, March the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is, What is an AI PC? Online virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. TED-Ed Connect meets Thursday, April the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and it's an online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The King's Bight Computer Club meets Tuesday, April the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to call for more information is 347-278-7320. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.